Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
From hedge funds to angel investors to bull markets. In the world of finance, names can sometimes be a bit misleading. Take ours, for instance. LSEG, a.k.a. London Stock Exchange Group. We're in London, and we have a stock exchange, but that's just part of what we do. Today, we connect the news, information, insights, and systems that make the markets work. You see, others do some of what we do, but not everything we do. LSEG.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 12th of November, these are our main stories. A doctor in Gaza says the situation in the biggest hospital there is becoming desperate.
Shooting and bombardment everywhere. You hear it at every second here around the Shifa Hospital. No one can get out from the Shifa Hospital. No one can come to the Shifa Hospital. Situation is very, very dangerous.
The Israelis say they'll help with the evacuation of babies to a safer hospital on Sunday. In London, some 300,000 people took part in a pro-Palestine march. Also in this podcast, thousands are evacuated as tremors indicate an imminent volcanic eruption in Iceland. And
you had options of oysters, salmon, beef. Here's a good one, squab a la Godard. That's pigeon. You had lamb, you had chicken. You had multiple courses.
Stay tuned to find out why someone was prepared to splash out more than $100,000, not on the meal, but on the menu card. In Gaza, doctors at the largest hospital there, Al-Shifa, say many patients, including premature babies, are at risk of dying, not because of disease, but because of a lack of power. One doctor described the scene as a war zone. His colleague, Al-Shifa's senior surgeon, Marwan Abu Sada, told the BBC it was becoming impossible to operate.
Shooting and bombardment everywhere. You hear it at every second here around the Shifa Hospital. No one can get out from the Shifa Hospital. No one can come to the Shifa Hospital. Situation is very, very dangerous. There is no water even in the main building, no electricity, no food even, and no fuel.
The Israeli military says Hamas has built its command center underneath the hospital, something denied by Hamas and by medical staff. Thousands of Palestinians who'd sought safety next to the hospital have been fleeing to the south of the territory. A reporter in Gaza, Rashdi Abu Alouf, watched them arrive at refugee camps.
More than 2,000-3,000 people already flee from the north and they arrived here in Khan Yunis. They were coming from Shifa Hospital. They said the situation remained very tense around the hospital with the tanks getting closer and closer to the gate of the hospital. Now very few people, like 5-6 people, they managed to escape under fire from the hospital this morning. But they told me about 10,000 people are remain in the courtyard of the hospital. No electricity there. Most of the operations are suspended, including the intensive care unit in the hospital. I managed to call a journalist who may be the last one who is there, and he described what is going on around the hospital as a real war. This is the biggest medical center. The biggest kidney dialysis department is in this hospital. The biggest surgery is in this hospital. Today, about 100 bodies were buried in the car park of the hospital because they said they were unable to move them to the cemetery and they have no space in the morgue. They said they were killed from an airstrike in a school yesterday nearby Shatta refugee camp close to the hospital. So they were buried in a mass grave in the car park of the hospital.
Rashdi Abu Alouf in Khan Yunis. For Israel's part, it maintains it's doing all it can to avoid civilian casualties and has said it will help evacuate babies from the Al-Shifa hospital to a safer hospital on Sunday. Daniel Hagari of the IDF blamed Hamas for the plight of Gaza's residents.
Hundreds of thousands of Gaza's residents have already moved south, and Hamas is doing everything in its power to prevent them from doing so. Hamas uses civilians as human shields. It is ready to endanger the lives of children of Gaza to protect itself. It has no limits.
A correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, told me more about what the Israelis had to say.
They insist that they are not targeting hospitals, despite everything that we've been hearing throughout the day from numerous medical sources. The Israelis say, yes, there is heavy fighting in the vicinity of these hospitals, but that the Israelis are not themselves targeting the hospitals. They're very emphatic about that. And in fact, in the case of Shifa, they say that it is not even under siege, that they have kept one side of the hospital, on the eastern side of the hospital, open so that people who want to leave can leave along one of the Gaza's main streets and rejoin the route that takes people away from Gaza City and down towards the southern end of the Gaza Strip. So the Israeli argument is, look, these places are being used by Hamas. We have to deal with that. But we do not want civilians caught up in the middle, and they are going to some lengths to try and persuade people to leave rather than just attack the hospitals in their current state.
And what about the military pauses that we understand have been agreed with the Israelis?
In a way, they're not really agreed. They're just unilateral. The Israelis are saying, we will keep these routes open. And what they are saying to the population from day to day is, if you are in, for example, Jabalia today, then you will be able to go out along this route and head south. And those orders are coming every day. They are for several hours. The purpose is only about evacuating civilians. And judging by the numbers who have left in the past few days, 150,000 or more, it seems to be a tactic that's working for Israel.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. The leaders of 57 Arab and Muslim countries have ended an emergency summit in Saudi Arabia by condemning Israel's military action in Gaza as well as its Western backers. But the meeting failed to produce concrete punitive measures, which some of the countries attending had called for. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner is in Riyadh.
Pretty much everybody from 57 Islamic nations, including all the Arab League countries, and that includes some pretty strange bedfellows. This is Saudi Arabia, and yet its historic rival in this region, Iran, sent its president, Ibrahim Raisi. And really, this was a kind of tale of two halves. You had some countries, such as Iran, Syria, Algeria, pushing for really concrete punitive measures to not so much punish Israel, but to punish Israel's backers, primarily the United States. Some people were calling for a closure of US bases in the region, for an end to the overflight rights of Israel over Arab countries, for a severing of relations, of diplomatic relations between Israel and countries like Bahrain, UAE. All of that was refused. But what they have had is a really resounding condemnation, not only of Israel's actions in Gaza, those who give it the green light, their words. And I would say that this summit isn't so much aimed at Israel, it's aimed at the United States. And there have been a lot of accusations of double standards saying, look, the West has been very quick to condemn Russia for its killing of civilians in Ukraine, but has been pretty muted about what's going on in Gaza.
Frank Gardner in Riyadh. Here in London, police say more than 300,000 protesters took part in a pro-Palestinian march. It was one of the biggest demonstrations of its type in recent years. About 2,000 police were deployed on the capital streets. The march went ahead despite days of highly charged political debate, with the British Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, labelling pro-Palestinian rallies as hate marches. The march coincided with Armistice Day, which commemorates the end of the First World War. The BBC's Home Affairs editor, Mark Easton, spent the day with police and protesters.
With a group of pro-Palestinian protesters now waving their flags and holding up their placards, one, interestingly, reads Armistice equals ceasefire and has a big red poppy on it.
Hi, my name is Professor Kamel Hawash. I'm the chair of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
And I noticed, sir, you're wearing a poppy.
It's an important day to remember those who died, but amongst them were 10,000 Palestinians who joined the British Army. So it's not a uniquely British remembrance. It brings all of that together.
The march has now begun here in Park Lane by Hyde Park, and it's all very peaceful, families and babies in pushchairs and dogs. But the Metropolitan Police say that there has been some disturbance elsewhere. They just issued a statement saying that while the two-minute silence was marked respectfully and without incident, there has been aggression from counter-protesters who are in the area in significant numbers. Different groups moving away from Whitehall towards other parts of central London, and officers are trying to keep track of them. Just outside the Metropolitan Police control room in Lambeth, just south of the river, a whole cavalcade of police vehicles have now just headed up towards Vauxhall Bridge, where we understand there has been a clash between far-right protesters and some of those who'd come to take part in the pro-Palestinian march. Police say they've arrested around 90 counter-protesters, and many of those have got previous convictions for football hooliganism. They've also arrested around a dozen pro-Palestinian demonstrators, allegedly making anti-Semitic chants or showing support for Hamas, a proscribed terrorist group. But with the main march now dispersing, Scotland Yard say they've successfully managed both to protect people's right to protest and the sanctity of Armistice Day.
Mark Easton. President Volodymyr Zelensky has marked the first anniversary of the liberation of Kherson from Russian occupiers by praising the city's residents for, as he put it, inspiring the world with their resistance. It comes amid fears expressed by some in Ukraine that the conflict against invading Russian forces has reached a stalemate, a description that Mr. Zelensky rejects. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, has this assessment.
Ukraine is facing a very different picture going into this winter than the last one. Its energy infrastructure is not yet being attacked with the same intensity. But on the territorial front, the picture is more sobering. Last autumn, Ukrainian troops had recaptured swathes of the northeastern Kharkiv region and lands west of the river Dnipro. Now, they've made few gains in a grueling counteroffensive that's already lasted over 5 months, and they're under pressure in the east. All this is set against a backdrop of many experts' appraisal that a long war favours Russia. President Zelensky is seizing on the Kherson anniversary to boost morale, evoking the emotions unleashed by the city's liberation. The message it symbolises, according to him, when unity prevails, Ukraine always returns to occupied lands.
The entire south of Ukraine learned last year that Russia never comes forever, no matter how many times they repeat it, because Ukraine always returns. When we know our goal, when we are in unity, today is one of the anniversaries that shape our Ukrainian confidence, that we can.
In essence, Mr. Zelensky was urging citizens in occupied or unoccupied parts of Ukraine, soldiers on the front lines, and also allies, to keep faith.
Danny Eberhard. The Titanic sank 111 years ago, but there is still great fascination with anything connected to the luxury liner, including, it seems, what people ate on board. On Saturday, a very rare item, a menu from the ship, fetched more than $100,000. It's dated April the 11th, 3 days before the ship struck an iceberg in the North Atlantic, leading to the loss of 1,500 lives. Andrew Aldridge is the managing director of the English auction house that organised the sale. And James Kumarasamy asked him what was on the menu that night.
Let's put it this way, they didn't go hungry. It was fairly opulent fare, as you would expect with a first-class menu on the Titanic. You had options of oysters, salmon, beef, here's a good one, squab a la Godard, that's pigeon. You had lamb, you had chicken, you had multiple courses.
And how was this menu preserved?
I was approached earlier in the year by a couple in Canada, and they were going through their father's possessions. He passed a few years before, and they were going through various albums of photographs and letters, etc. And they opened up a page and this menu staring out at them. 48 hours later, I opened the package and I was like, OMG, this is the real deal. Completely unique menu. Ironically, there are more April the 14th menus than other menus. And the simple answer to that is she hit the berg late on April the 14th. Gentlemen were dressed in their smart suits. having their dinner. And it happens today on a liner that you have a very nice dinner. You'll take the menu as a souvenir. You get back to your cabin. The ship hits the berg. You get on deck. It's cold. You give your wife your dinner jacket because you want to keep them warm. They'll get in a lifeboat. They're saved. They get to New York. They open the jacket, feel inside, and there's a menu.
What do you say to people who might wonder whether there's something a little bit lurid about collecting items from people who died in this way?
These particular items, we're talking about these men 111 years afterwards. We've got a watch in this sale. A gentleman called Sinor Cantor. He was a Belarusian, and he was travelling to the US to study medicine with his wife. He drowned. She lived. His watch went back to his wife. Her descendants sold it about 10 years ago. Through that piece of memorabilia, that man's memory is kept alive. You know, we're still talking about these people 111 years later. And that's why people are interested in these objects. You know, it's a question I'm asked all the time by the media. Why are people still talking about this 111 years later? Distill the story to its basic essence. It's a large liner, hits an iceberg, sinks with a horrific loss of life. But where the interest of this lies is you've got 2,200 plus people on that ship. Every man, woman and child on that ship has a story to tell. Those stories in many ways are told through this memorabilia, and that's why we're still talking about it.
Andrew Aldridge speaking to James Kumarasamy. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
For all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form.
Remembering the astronaut Frank Borman, who led the first ever moon mission and has died at the age of 95.
Suddenly my quilt is ripped off me and then my room is full of white men. And I thought, I'm done for. These are fascists. They found where I live.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In Sudan, an important bridge that crossed the River Nile in the capital Khartoum has been destroyed. The Sudanese army and rival paramilitary group, the RSF, blame each other for the destruction. A senior United Nations official says the violence being waged against civilians is verging on pure evil. Dr. Abubakar Bakri is head of operations for Sudan for the medical charity MSF. He's based in Nairobi, but he has colleagues working inside Sudan.
If there's no immediate actions taken now by allowing the humanitarian assistance, especially in Darfur and inside Khartoum, we'll definitely see a total collapse and shutdown of the health system anytime. Inside Khartoum and in Darfur, bullets are flying everywhere. There's no safe place at all. People are in continuous displacement. It's a daily struggle for everyone there.
Dr. Abubakar Bakri. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, has been following the latest developments on the ground.
The Shambat Bridge was blown up at dawn. There was a massive explosion. If you look at a map, it's on the sort of bottleneck of the Nile before it splits into two, the Blue Nile and the White Nile. And it was really connecting the three separate parts of Greater Khartoum. And its destruction is probably more disadvantageous to the paramilitary, the RSF, because it was the only bridge that they controlled. So now they can't move their troops around.
And what does it mean for residents, people living there?
Yes, yeah, so the other three bridges across the White Nile are all contested between the army and the RSF. So it was the only bridge that the civilians could use to get across from one side to the other. So it now means that some families are divided and stranded on separate sides of the Nile. And of course, also, this will add to the massive costs of eventual reconstruction that the damage is estimated as hundreds of billions of dollars.
Now, it's nearly 7 months since the conflict in Sudan started. Where are we now in this?
So it's raging on despite the resumption of peace talks in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. It seems that the RSF was getting the upper hand. They've committed widespread war crimes and human rights abuses in Darfur. And analysts say that Sudan is moving towards what's happened in Libya, where you end up getting two rival governments. So you may have the RSF taking control of Khartoum and Darfur and the army being based in Port Sudan. And so far, around 10,000 people have died and nearly 6 million displaced.
Richard Hamilton. More than 3,000 people are facing a second night in temporary accommodation in southwestern Iceland, where a major volcanic eruption could occur at any moment. Measurements show an underground lava flow almost 10 kilometres long is building up in the area. The head of Iceland's civil defence, Vidar Reynisson, warned residents not to return.
The situation now is that the area is closed to everyone, so it is not permitted to go there to save valuables and check on houses. We do not know how long this situation will last, but we'll keep you informed as soon as there are any changes. Be prepared for this to last for quite some time.
Here's more from our reporter, Risto Pico.
The warning signs had been there for weeks. Thousands of earthquakes had been shaking the Reykjanes Peninsula. The tremors are caused by a huge magma flow, an underground river of molten rock 5 miles long that runs from the inland mountains to the coastal town of Grindavík. Overnight, the quakes became stronger and more frequent and more focused on the area around the town, where an evacuation was ordered at midnight. The operation passed smoothly. All 3,300 inhabitants were with family and friends or in temporary accommodation within hours. But it may be some time before they can return home. There are no signs of the magma flow getting weaker, and as long as that remains the case, the danger of a destructive eruption in the town persists.
Risto Pico. Back now to our top story, the conflict in Gaza. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a television address on Saturday, said Israeli forces had killed thousands of Hamas terrorists near the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza. He said Hamas is an integral part of the Iranian axis of evil, and he vowed that the fight would continue.
The war against Hamas, ISIS, is going full force, and it has one objective: to win. There is nothing other than a victory. We will eradicate Hamas and we will bring back our hostages.
The words of Benjamin Netanyahu through an interpreter. The BBC has been following the lives of 5 people inside Gaza as they face almost daily bombardment. Today we hear the experience of 27-year-old vlogger Ayat.
We have no bread at home. My brother went to the bakery, but it was packed. The queue was 6 hours long. But we have a neighbor who has a mud oven and bakes for everyone in the neighborhood. So we decided to make the dough at home, and then he would bake it for us because there's no gas or electricity to use. The situation is tragic. We used to live a beautiful life, a normal life, a life full of creativity and ideas, of dreams and ambition. But now, the Israeli occupation has destroyed everything. It has killed everything inside of us. To fill up this gallon bottle of drinking water, my brother saw hell. He walked more than 6 kilometers and stood in a line and waited. Hours later, he finally managed to fill it up. This is the sound of the drones, the buzzing surveillance planes in the skies above Gaza. And there are many of them across the sky. This is the night in Gaza. Fire on the horizon, constant bombing. The sound of the buzzing drones do not stop. Missiles everywhere, no air is safe. All of us in Gaza are martyrs waiting to be killed. Every day there's a bombing in Gaza. They bombed everything. They bombed the mosques, the schools, the churches, and the hospitals. They bombed the residential towers and buildings. They bombed homes of civilians. We are people full of life, of ambition and creativity and positive ideas. We like change, and we want to develop our community, to become leading and active figures of society. We love, build, and grow. But unfortunately, the occupation is killing everything, destroying everything. They don't have mercy. We wish this nightmare to end.
Vlogger Ayat in Gaza. On Friday on the Global News podcast, we heard President Emmanuel Macron of France in an interview with the BBC calling on Israel to stop bombing babies, women, the elderly and civilians. Mr. Macron said there was no reason for it and stated there should be an immediate ceasefire. But President Macron is also concerned about Ukraine, as he told our Europe editor, Katia Adler.
Let's imagine we stop helping Ukraine. Probably they will be defeated. For Europeans, it means there is no more serious an architecture of security in this continent. Because you will have a new imperial power, because definitely it's imperialism and colonialism that Russia is doing. So you have a new imperial power having defeated a big country of 40 million inhabitants close to your door. So I think there is no better option than helping Ukraine to resist, to put itself in a situation to have fair and good negotiations, and to come back at the table and find a solution with Russia, but in a situation where they could defend both their territory and their security.
So not yet?
I think it's not yet the case. I'm not the one to decide the right moment. This is the two parties being on the ground. But this is the Ukrainians to decide any type of negotiation. But I think our duty is to help Ukraine to remain committed and in parallel to progress on NATO and EU track.
The United States has been key for supporting
yes.
Ukraine alongside Europe. But we don't know who's going to end up in the White House next year after presidential elections. Can Europe go it alone?
We are very lucky to have such an administration in the US. Let's be clear. Because they are committed and they have a very reasonable diplomacy. Meaning helping this democracy to protect its territory, meaning Ukraine, without creating any escalation. Second, I don't make any bet on US domestic policies. I want to believe it should be a bipartisan consensus because it clearly what is at stake is as well UN Charter principles, territorial integrity and sovereignty. Third, I think the Europeans have to clearly endorse their role. We speak about our direct neighbourhood and this is our duty to be more and more engaged.
Are you concerned that things feel more and more polarised? I mean, whether it's over Israel-Gaza, whether it's over Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or when it comes to a subject very close to your heart, which is climate change.
Globally, we have more and more polarisation for quite simple reason. People are over-informed, but through social networks and a lot of platforms, argument is less powerful than emotion, and negative emotion is more powerful than positive emotion. If you have such a merit order, which is exactly the one create a lot of traffic and reactions, people are overdetermined by the negative emotions they feel. So this is why you have a big issue now on migration and big polarization on migration, geopolitics, climate, etc., etc. The big risk is that it creates a pressure on leaders. And more leaders follow the people, follow this reaction, and in a certain way probably creates new divisions in this world.
The French President Emmanuel Macron speaking to Katia Adler. And finally, over the Christmas period back in 1968, three NASA astronauts became the first people to orbit the moon. One of them was Frank Borman, who's now died at the age of 95 at his home in Montana in the United States. He commanded the mission that started an extraordinary phase in spaceflight and exploration, and he took part in one of its landmark moments. The historian and author, Robert Curson, who knew Frank Borman well, has been talking to us about Frank's life and work and why he wanted to go into space.
Frank wasn't interested in going into space to expand mankind's horizons or to pick up space rocks. He was in it for one reason and one reason only, and that was to defeat the Soviet Union.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project.
Apollo 8 occurred suddenly as a result of a secret memo obtained by American intelligence that indicated that the Soviet Union was ready to fly men around the moon by the end of 1968. Frank Borman was called suddenly to Houston for an emergency and highly, highly secret meeting where they told him, Frank, we want you to go to the moon.
I got a call from Houston, Dick Slayton, my boss. I walked in his office. He told me that the CIA had recently determined that the Russians were planning a circumlunar flight before the end of the year. and that the powers that be in NASA decided to make Apollo 8 a circumlunar flight and go without a limb to the moon. And I said, yes, let's go. That's what we're here for.
This morning, three Americans, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders, are on the verge of making man's first journey to the moon.
We have to remember that they were riding the Saturn V rocket, which remains to this day, in 2023, the most powerful machine ever built.
The engines are armed. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have liftoff.
They first made an Earth orbit. Everything was going well, and then they launched toward the moon. But on the way, Frank Borman got very ill.
This is Apollo Control, Houston. We've learned that there is a little nausea aboard. Frank Borman.
And there was a very serious meeting among the heads of NASA debating about whether to call this flight back. But when you ask Frank about it, he would always say, we would have had radio failure. So Frank and his crew were not intending to come back from mankind's first ever journey to the moon.
Transmission is coming to you approximately halfway between the moon and the Earth. Less than 40 hours left to go to the moon.
So when Frank was informed that they were going to do broadcasts live back to Earth, he didn't seem to want very much to do with that.
This Apollo 8 flight, in my mind, was designed to beat the Russians to the moon. And anything that would not contribute to that, I was against. NASA told me I was wrong and overruled me, and they were right.
Enjoying the Earth. It's a beautiful, beautiful view with a predominantly blue background.
They had plans to take pictures because part of this mission was to prepare for the Apollo 11 landing. But nobody told them what to expect. And when they finally got there, all three of them were totally speechless and wide-eyed. Bill Anders, the youngest of the three-man crew, shot what would probably become the most famous photograph ever taken. It's known today as Earthrise, and it's something that Apollo 8 will be known for forever, I think.
It was Christmas. There in the far distance was our home. That was the only thing in space that had any color. It was basically blue. You could see the white clouds and the kind of brownish pink planet. It was a beautiful view.
From the first minutes that I spent with him, he was the nicest, smartest, funniest, and often warmest person I dealt with in many, many years.
We had a wonderful flight, and I want to thank you as Americans for helping make it possible. Thanks a lot.
Frank Borman will be remembered for many things, but one of the things he'll be most remembered for is the reading from the book of Genesis. A third of the world's population is tuned in. From all across the world, people are hanging on the words of these three men who on Christmas Eve have reached the moon. But nobody has any idea what the astronauts are going to say.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form.
And it is Frank who begins by saying, in the beginning. And it is also Frank who says goodbye to everyone just moments before the radio signal and television signal from the moon goes dark. And it's Frank who speaks the final moving and stirring words that I think he'll be remembered for forever.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
The voice of Frank Borman, remembered there by Robert Curson. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Jack Graysmark. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye.
From hedge funds to angel investors to bull markets. In the world of finance, names can sometimes be a bit misleading. Take ours, for instance. LSEG, a.k.a. London Stock Exchange Group. We're in London, and we have a stock exchange, but that's just part of what we do. Today, we connect the news, information, insights, and systems that make the markets work. You see, others do some of what we do, but not everything we do. LSEG.